On this podcast, we're breaking the silence. Welcome to Mental Health. It's time to talk. Here's your host, Alan Kaler.
Thank you, everyone, for taking the time to tune in. And today, I am very excited to bring you California's own, their pride and their joy, Jesse Brizendine. Jesse, welcome to the show.
I have never been introduced as California's own and their pride and joy. Well done.
Well, I think I was spot on with that, was I not?
I've been saying that for a long time, and you were the first one to finally recognize it, Al. So I appreciate you all the more now for that.
Beautiful. Beautiful. Jesse, I want to dive right in right now. Grief and loss is something that you have dealt with personally, and I know that it's also something that you're passionate about putting a voice to. Your TED Talk, Grief is Not a Life Sentence, has been very well received. And I know, now I'm going to be at risk of coming across as like a psychologist because I want to dive into your childhood. But Jesse, there was this point where you shared with me that at a very early age, age 8 or 9, there was a moment where you were standing outside with a knife to your heart and you were just done. You were just done. So that trauma, that grief was there at a very early age. What exactly led up to something so significant at a young age?
Yeah. Thanks, Al, for the setup with that. I think I was about five years old, maybe, when my mom turned to me in the car. We had just finished, or we were getting ready to ride bikes at the local park. And she looked at me and said, Do you know what a divorce is? She proceeded to tell me that her and my father had been having problems and about behaviors that he'd been doing that she didn't agree with. And then she asked me the question that broke my heart. If they were to split up, who would I want to live with? Who would I want to live with? Which is it's a loaded question, because at that age, right, you're really trying to please your parents and you have different things that you associate with both of them. Obviously, my mom was the one there taking me to ride bikes, and my dad would be the one to play some sports and stuff with me. And I remember my mom saying that she would hope that I'd want to live with her, and that if they, but she then said that they were going to try to work it out and stay together so that my brother and I didn't have to grow up in two separate homes. And what I heard in that moment, Al, was that my mom was going to willfully subject herself to being unhappy at my expense. From that day forward, I viewed every single thing that my mom did, every happy moment and every sad moment, through the lens of she was doing this for me, or she was suffering because of me. And one of the things that really plagued my mom was financial challenges. We lived in a very small home that was rented. It was, dilapidated repairs. Rent was always late. I would routinely have to carry the paltry rent up, 3 weeks, 4 weeks late, and they'd send me up to submit it, because they felt that they would be much less likely to evict a young child than they would parents who weren't paying the rent on time. It got to a point, though, where I couldn't handle my mom's suffering anymore. And I felt so responsible for it. And I had worked out in my young 8, 9-year-old mind that if I was dead, then it would save my mom money. And if my mom was saving money, she'd have money. And if she had money, then she'd be happy. I felt like my mom loved me, but I felt as much as I was the source of love for her, I was also the source of the pain I saw her in constantly. So one day I took a knife from my dad's room. My parents slept in separate rooms. Went down to the woods behind my house, and I fell down to the knees on the forest floor. I took the knife out, and I pressed it into my chest. I was sobbing uncontrollably when I was doing this, because I didn't want to die. I was terrified to die, but I felt like I had to die because it was the only thing I felt like I could do to show my mom, to love my mom and let my mom be freed, to give her the opportunity to finally be happy. As I started to push the knife in towards where I thought my heart was, I started to cry even more because it hurt. It wasn't like the TV shows and the movies I saw where it seemed that it was so effortless to take a life with a knife. It was hard. There was resistance. There was tissue and bone. So I kept pushing harder and I was shaking. I mean, I was just in full convulsions because the tears were flowing and I didn't want to die. I was so scared to death. But I felt like I had to. And finally, I pushed hard enough where it broke the skin and blood started to trickle down my chest. And at the sight of my own blood, I got so scared that I knew I couldn't go through with it. So I fell to the floor just sobbing uncontrollably, because in that moment, not only did I realize I couldn't go through with it, but I felt the deepest, what I would now describe as shame, that I ever felt in my life. It was kind of like the scarlet letter where the lady walked around the rest of her life with a big A. I felt like for the rest of my life, I was branded with a big S. And I remember walking home after that, how my head hanging as low as it could possibly hang, sobbing uncontrollably, because now not only could I not take my life, meaning I was going to subject my mom to an indefinite amount of time of suffering, but I was a coward because I just couldn't do it. And from that time forward, I was ruthless to myself. Every day for most of my adolescent life, I would spend sometimes upwards of 30 minutes in front of a little hand mirror, picking my nose because I was so terrified if I had one booger visible, people would see me, it would expose me for the ugly, horrible person that I knew myself to be. Throughout junior high and all of high school, I would routinely spend 5-10 minutes in front of the mirror looking myself in the eye, telling myself how horrible I was, how awful I was, how I was God's punishment to my parents, how I was just this black plague on the face of the earth. And I carried just a heavy, heavy toll on my heart for so long because I just felt like that my existence, every time I drew breath, was literally taking a breath out of the happiness that my mom could experience in life.
I appreciate you going to that place, Jesse. I have a hard time just trying to understand the gravity and the depth of that kind of despair that, you know, Jesse as a boy had to carry, and that hurts so much for you to have to carry around. And the impact that that word shame has had on your life, for it to be so profound. And actually, I remember, Jesse, there was a time when you said to me, even I think it was when you were in high school, that you were sitting on a bench by yourself and you did not want to be seen, and yet every part of you wanted to be seen. Was that something that continuously played out as well then?
Oh yeah. And I forgot to send you that video. I got to remember to send it to you. Yeah. Al, so there was when I went into high school, I remember for the first week, maybe 2 weeks, my freshman year in high school, I was covered head to toe in hives because I was so terrified of now going to this new place where because of the shame I felt, I had so much anxiety and so socially awkward. I was terrified of meeting people. I was terrified of ever doing anything that would remotely screw up. So I always was really quiet, kept to myself, didn't try to do anything that rocked the boat because I didn't want to add to the already grief, despair, and hurt that I felt like I was creating for my mom just by being alive. Actually, I can remember one time a kid gave me a piece of gum in junior high, and you know, junior high, I mean, a gum offense carries detention or something like that. And for me, I didn't dare even take it. You might as well have been giving me crack or something like that, because it felt like if I were to get some sort of blemish on my record, it would just be more pain and more hurt for my mom. There had been one time I remember that some friends of mine in third, fourth grade were wrestling around, you know, just playing as kids do. Everybody was laughing, throwing a football around, and a teacher observed it from afar and thought they were fighting. There was nothing even close to a fight. Everybody was smiling, laughing. They had tried to get me involved, but I stood as far away as possible from it by why I still be on the outskirts, because I was terrified again of getting in trouble because I was afraid what it would do to my mom. Well, the teacher had no patience whatsoever for even trying to understand. And as many adults often assume for children, they assume that they know everything that's going on and that their rule of law is final. So we were sent to the principal's office and then all got these little pink slips. And you talk about magnifying shame. I remember my mom would barely even talk to me for a week after that. because of how it made her look amongst her peers. She happened to be at work at the school system. So you fast forward now where I go into high school, and I am so socially awkward, so insecure, so shy, covered head to toe in hives. My one or two friends who I had growing up in elementary school quickly got into drug culture and went to a different place. So I found myself very alone. And there was this one spot, there was this kind of like a, almost like a circular building in the middle of the campus. And on the backside of that circular building, there was a bench. And, you know, as many high school campuses may have, there's gum stuck under the bench and on the ground around it that people just drop. And I would go and routinely eat lunch there, because it was kind of hidden away from everyone, so no one could see me. But every now and then people would walk by because there was a cafeteria down there and the gym was over there, and there'd be like different shops, classes and stuff like that. And I would often bow and duck my head, avoiding eye contact, avoiding anyone seeing me. But at the same time, I so desperately wanted to be seen. I wanted to have someone extend their hand and say, hey, do you want to come eat lunch with us? I wanted to have someone say, hey, aren't you in my English class? Hey, don't I know you from math? Oh yeah, you know, we had played basketball together or something like that. But I didn't even have the ability to do that myself, Al. And it didn't stop in high school too. I remember, gosh, going into college, the first time there was a student introduced themselves to me. We were standing in line to get our student ID cards. He extends his hand and introduces himself. And I had this moment where I realized, God, I've never had anybody shake my hand before like this. And I broke out in a full sweat, skipped pink, skipped red, went straight to purple with embarrassment. And that was how much of my late teenage years were, was that it was this constant oscillation of trying to hide, but desperately wanting to be seen, wanting to make friends, wanting to connect with people, but being so awkward and so uncomfortable in my own skin that I completely lacked the capacity and ability to do that.
That is a lot to navigate through. And what stands out for me, Jesse, is obviously everybody is fighting a battle that we know nothing about. And I feel as though so many people who hear or know the name Jesse Brissendine see you for where you are today. You know, the entrepreneur, you've been able to work with numerous celebrities as a life coach, you know, published author, well-known speaker, and I feel like a lot of people don't really understand the depth of the struggles before where you are now. And I'm curious then, with all of those challenges, all that loss, all that shame, how were you able to eventually turn a corner to get to where you are today?
I learned when I was about 18 years old that if I got really drunk, I would lose enough inhibition that I was able to be a little bit more sociable. I was able to communicate, you know, as much as you can communicate when you're borderline blacked out drunk. But it was far better communication than I was doing when I was sober. And I took to partying a lot. And I had a pretty strong tolerance. And I realized that around some other socially awkward guys, if you had someone like me who, and they looked at me and thought I was athletic and had my shit together and thought that, oh, this guy can drink so much. So it was like this kind of, wow, I'm getting these accolades and recognition for something. Felt kind of good. And I would routinely push the limits of how much alcohol I could consume. I remember one day, and I don't really remember it that well, but I remember the next day more. I remember us ordering pizza and I had just drank without stopping this bottle of 99-cent liquor store wine that some guy had gotten from, as he said, quote, a corrupt Korean liquor store in downtown Los Angeles. The wine tasted like it had long ago fermented and tasted more like vinegar than anything else. But 18 years old with the most fragile ego you can imagine and all these expectations and peer pressure of, oh, you got to drink it. And because nobody else would, I felt like I needed to give it a go. So I gulped it down and then began to follow it up with a bottle of vodka. Last thing I remember from that day is there was a pizza on the dorm floor, and we were all sitting around eating pizza. And I remember looking at the floor thinking, my God, it is spinning so fast. I don't remember anything after that until I woke up the next morning. And when I woke up, there was my bedspread was gone. They had this stuff in the dorm rooms called vomit dust that people, the resident attendant, the upperclassman who stayed with the freshman, would throw over the floor to soak up vomit. My clothes were gone. I was in different clothes than I was the night before. And I happened to crawl myself out of bed because I had 8 a.m. class and was asking what in the heck happened. And it turned out that I had gotten so sick that I spent 3 hours throwing up in the public restroom toilet, head buried in the toilet. And we have all been in public restrooms and we know what those are like. And they thought they were gonna have to get my stomach pumped. That didn't happen. So now I get put on, what happens when you're underage drinking in the dorms, you get put on probation from the dorm. So I get put on probation from the dorm. My grades, because of all the partying had gotten so bad in UCSB where I went to school, was on a quarter system. In my first quarter, I got a 1.13 GPA, which they send you a nice letter for that basically says, in a very politically correct way, if you don't get your shit together, we're going to kick you out because you're effing up our curve here. Here I find myself on probation, about ready to get kicked out of the dorms, about ready to get kicked out of school. Vomit dust, don't know what happened the night before. And about a couple weeks after that, I remember going to the bathroom and standing in front of the mirror. And I didn't have my shirt on because I was going in to brush my teeth. I'm so awkward, Al, that what I used to do is I would do a bunch of push-ups before I would walk down, and then I'd take my shirt off and do sit-ups and try to flex really hard and see if maybe some girls would notice me that way. And because the bathroom was right next to my door. And I'm sitting there brushing my teeth, and I look in the mirror and I realize I don't even recognize the guy looking back. This shy, insecure, who still had this really good heart, but this shy, insecure kid was so broken inside that I had these dark circles under my eyes. I was starting to get a beer belly, and I didn't even recognize myself. And I remember looking at myself in the mirror. I remember looking at myself and saying, like, what are you doing? You work so hard to give yourself a shot at life, a different life than where you grew up. And you're about to throw it all away. Why? Because you're so scared. You're so self-conscious. You're so insecure. You think so little of yourself. Why don't you just give yourself a chance? Like, what would that even look like? In that moment, I made a deal with myself. I pledged to myself I was going to spend the next quarter getting my grades up. And once I did that, I was going to start the following quarter working out, because I realized that maybe part of the reason I felt so poorly about myself was because I had struggled with body images all of childhood. I had been really chunky as a kid and then went to really chunky to really skinny. I didn't really have a firm identity of my own. And I always resonated with the Arnold Schwarzenegger movies and all the muscles. And I always wanted that, but never knew how I could get that. And long story short, I got my grades up that next quarter. Then I started working out. And as I began working out and I started to physically feel better about myself, what I didn't expect to happen was I started to mentally and emotionally feel better about myself.
Yeah. And physical fitness has been something that you've embraced over the years. I mean, that's really only one area on your journey towards being well, so to speak. And I know that you're at a place today that doesn't even compare to where you were. I mean, you know, there's a comment here from Steve that pops up, just making sure that you know that you're loved. And I know where you're at today, and I know that you feel that. And you and I both work with a lot of men who are genuinely struggling with value, and they're continuously navigating through their grief, through their loss, through their shame. What else, other than the physical, allowed you to get to where you are today? What are some of those tangible tools that you help empower other men to find?
Yeah, you know, with men, Al, it's an interesting dynamic, because men were taught, and I think so inadequately prepared, about what life really throws at us. And what I mean by that is the emotion of life. Life is far more complicated emotionally than 2 + 2 = 4, or this is right and that's wrong. And for men, we're fixers. We're taught that if there's a problem, you're supposed to fix it. The challenge is how the hell do you fix emotions and feelings, especially when those emotions and feelings are often originating from how you're being perceived by someone else, something that happened at work, something someone said about you, or more specifically, what you're saying about you, about someone else said about you. It is imperative for men, I think, that if they really want to enhance the quality of their life, to allow themselves the gift of becoming more emotionally connected with themselves, to feel their feelings, not flee them, but feel them. And feeling your feelings is not going with the traditional, if we were to say the traditional stereotypical male approach is, I feel this, I can't feel this, I'm going to stuff it down and then use anger to mask it. Or I feel this, I'm going to stuff it down and use humor to mask it. Feeling it is being real. Feeling it is being raw. Feeling it is being honest. Feeling it is saying, gosh, I don't have the fucking slightest clue what to do right now. And I'm scared. Because what happens is when we start allow ourselves to feel, we start to give ourselves that permission out in those crucial moments, we create a new possibility for ourselves. And that's the possibility that it can be okay to feel what we feel. See, for most of us, especially men, you know, I do some mentorship with widowed men. Widowed men are three times more likely to take their life after the partner passes than women are. Three times, right? And the recipes right there in front of us, massive amounts of sadness, grief, despair, depression, guilt, don't know what to do with it, don't know how to articulate it, can't get away from it. What else is there to do? So when we allow ourselves to acknowledge and give ourselves permission to feel what we are in that moment, we're allowing ourselves to acknowledge that it's okay to not have the answers. It's okay to have a problem in front of us that's not solvable. And the very act of doing that actually, ironically enough, gives us a foundation to be in to be able to start to solve the problem. We cannot get to, it's like, you know, if you're trying to clear out a drain, a clog in the drain, you have to wade through all the murky, icky stuff that has swam up to the surface to be able to get down to the source of the clog. You have to. You're not going to clear the drain out by just dumping more water on it, dumping more water on it, dumping more water, hoping that eventually the water washes away all the muck and yuck. Or sometimes in men's cases, I think we dump more beer on it or more alcohol on it or whatever it is. We have to get through the icky stuff, the nasty parts, the scary stuff, the stuff that we don't want to. And it's funny because men, we pride ourselves on being so strong and tough, and we're supposed to be fearless too, right? Many of the movies and TV shows we were all raised with show that when danger approaches, the man's supposed to jump up and protect his family and have the answers and charge out into the dark. I was just watching some movie this morning I had never seen before. And true to form, a rock goes crashing through the door during a dinner party. And it's the guy who jumps up and grabs the baseball bat and goes charging out into the unknown. And everybody else kind of sits back and waits to see what happens. When it comes to our emotions, though, there's not really a baseball bat that's going to solve those problems and take it away that easy. It's not as simple as just turning the lights on and all of a sudden we can see that the ghost that we thought was in the corner was really just a jacket put over the chair. Oftentimes, too, these emotions have deeper-seated pieces, right? How I was feeling about myself at 19, 20, 21 years old was many parts away tied how I was feeling about myself at 4, 5, 6 years old. The shame I felt after getting put on probation from the dorms was directly tied to the shame I felt without being able to kill my, without being able to take my life when I was 8. And these are complex entities that exist inside of all of us. And if we don't first allow ourselves to acknowledge the presence of the emotion, stop bullshitting ourselves like there's nothing wrong and it's okay and that we just need to suck it up and get over with it. That very language, the language that many of us were so incorrectly taught, is going to be one of the biggest sources of our problems and our mental health struggles going forward.
Yeah, you say it well, Jesse. You say it well. Ultimately, it is the act of feeling that leads to healing. And so many of us just want to be free from the pain. And that's logical. It's logical to want to leave the pain in exchange for pleasure. And yeah, we want the fix now. We want to get better now. You gave yourself permission to feel, which is usually the hardest thing. Yes. Like just that first step of giving yourself permission to feel. Then you understood the value of putting a voice to your pain. Yes. And you have used your lived experiences to then greatly assist others. I know that when you did the TEDx talk, that grief is not a life sentence, you were very focused on wanting it to not just be like a fire hose message, if you will, but you wanted it to be actionable. And what are some of those key pieces in addition to feeling, talking, that people can use to just navigate through that grief and loss?
Yeah. If we look at grief specifically, so when I went through my first really heavy bout of grief, and this is after childhood stuff, because I didn't really understand that as grief in the way that, you know, you and I can have a conversation about it now. It wasn't until one of my closest friends took his life that I started to really be present to grief. He had gone through a hard time. There was some stuff that happened. Long story short, I found him. He was still alive. He had just shot himself. I went through that whole piece with trying to keep him alive, CPR, calling 911, paramedics. And he ended up having traumatic brain injury, passed away 24 hours later. And when that happened, it brought up this wave of grief I hadn't experienced before, because I had never lost someone who I loved in that way. I had never been through something so violent and so intense. I had never experienced the fallouts of grief, friendships that I had formed at that time in suffering because people didn't know how to interact with me or treat me, you know, tiptoeing around me like I was some broken, fragile piece of china that if the one false move happened, that there was a little fart in the wind, it was going to cause the china to crack and crumble. My girlfriend who I was with at the time, she couldn't handle me being sad. She didn't sign up to be in a relationship with sad Jesse. She signed up in a relationship to be with happy and inspired Jesse. So she bails. This isn't for me. When that grief started to happen, you start to become present to people's perceptions of you, how people experience you. And at the time, I didn't ask questions. I just accepted. I accepted the well-intentioned advice of most people, which is, you know, grief has no timeline. It may get better with time. You may grieve the rest of your life. And for me, that was so unacceptable. I felt so lost and so broken that the idea of continuing to live that way just seemed not okay to me. I had already spent most of my young life being sad and depressed and unhappy with myself. I didn't want to start spiraling down and going back to those dark places. I wish I could tell you, Al, that I had my light bulb moment then. And it wasn't until my father passed away unexpectedly 6 months after that, and then my best friend was killed in a car crash a couple years after that, that I learned that one of the keys in navigating through grief and loss is to start ask questions and have conversations with your emotions. See, up until that point, I was just accepting. And when I felt depressed, what I would do is I wouldn't say I feel depressed. I'd say I am depressed. I wouldn't say I feel sad. I'd say I am sad. And that's a really tricky place we have to navigate. And unfortunately, in the pill-popping, big pharmaceutical culture that we are, and this isn't a hit on that necessarily, because I think there's a lot of really great things that have been created to help people at different times. But I think there's a linguistic shift right now where we are taking emotions, feelings that we're supposed to feel, and we're creating identities behind them. So it's not uncommon for me to say, I am sad or I am depressed, rather than I feel sad and I feel depressed. There's two differences, right? There's a difference of I feel this is much different than saying I am this. And in those early trials with grief, I am. It was my identity. And so when we start to take that identity on, we all have a blueprint inside of our mind of what that is, right? If I were to tell each and every person watching and listening right now, say, you know, what is the posture? What is the physiology of someone who's depressed, of someone who's sad, of someone who's angry? We all know what that looks like. We can all put our body in those positions. Well, if that starts to become our identity, we're going to start to mirror that. And as we start to mirror it, we're going to start to experience it more. And as we start to experience it more, we're going to reinforce the belief that that's who we are. And feelings evolve very quickly into facts. And emotions that we experience evolve very quickly into identities of who we are. What I started to learn when I began to ask questions was, what if feelings aren't facts? What if they're actually messengers? What if they are literally that annoying salesperson who keeps knocking at the door and you just won't answer because it's Sunday morning and you're trying to enjoy the cartoons, but they keep knocking, 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 wanting you to open the door, wanting you to just listen to them, but you think, they don't have anything I want. I don't need it. I don't want to give up cartoons, but they keep knocking. And then you finally go to the door and all of a sudden they deliver something that you didn't expect. I begin to ask myself that question. What if our emotions are the same? What if my feeling of sadness wasn't coming up to reinforce this identity that you are sad? What if it was to come up and to try to tell me that, or to hint at me like, you are feeling sadness right now. Where would you like to feel? Where would you like to go? What would you like to feel instead? Because think about this. Our unconscious mind cannot process a negative. Easy example of this is if I say, do not think of your favorite flavor of ice cream. What immediately comes to mind, right, is your favorite flavor of ice cream. Even though I told you not to think about it, you still thought about it. You have to first think about what you're not supposed to think about to not think about it. Well, if we're literally interpreting our emotions as identities, and if we play in that same space of maybe they're messengers, and our unconscious mind delivers us this identity of sadness or this feeling of sadness, the opportunity becomes to engage a conversation with it. So I started to do that. When I would feel sad, instead of saying, I am sad, I started to say, wow, you're right. I do feel sad right now. What would I like to feel instead? And the very action of asking that question, it created a new possibility, a new opportunity for me to experience something different. And just the same as everybody may have just felt that energetically exchanged between all of us, I felt something shift in me. Well, wow, that's really interesting. I never thought about that before. You mean I could feel something different? I don't have to feel this right now? And so he'd come up and say, well, I would like to feel happy. I'd like to feel better. And then it leads to a follow-up question. What would make me happy right now? What would make me feel better? Well, what would make me happy right now is, you know, you really love drinking those smoothies that Al said he didn't want to drink. Why don't you go make yourself one? Al and I were joking before recording about the green drink I was drinking. But it opened up this door, Al, and it allowed me to become a detective and treat my own inner monologue not as a judge reading off my execution orders, but rather as a philosopher presenting something for me to interpret. Some new net land for me to navigate and explore. So that was the first thing, is for people to ask questions. The second thing is we have to be honest with ourselves, especially when we're looking at grief and the loss of a loved one. What I mean about that is one of the lies of loss that will languish long after someone is gone and cause some of the biggest sources of grief and pain is the lie that I should have, would have, could have, and if only. Right? I should have been more kind. I should have made more phone calls. If only I would have this. And what we do is we start to feel and heap guilt upon ourselves. Many of us, when we start to plague ourselves with that should have, would have, could have, and we feel bad about our lack of presence, our ineptness to connect and communicate with the people we love, we will use guilt as a way to almost kind of quantify love. And so we create these weird dynamics in our unconscious of, well, the more pain I feel means the more I loved. So I got to feel more pain to be able to demonstrate I love. And men, I see men do this often because it's in a weird male, we need to compete way. Men will start to do the proverbial sometimes pissing match over grief and depths of grief and despair because it's just them trying to figure out how to cope with what they're feeling. Right. I don't feel like I'm in control of this right now. So something I can control is I can win this kind of battle, the battle that nobody wants to win. The honesty piece comes to this. Al, I love and care about you as a friend. If you were to die today, I would be heartbroken. I would cry. I would be sad. I would feel grief. I would give myself permission to feel, to sob, to be angry, to express all those things, which we all need to do. And then just like I just did, I would take a deep breath. After the tears abated, after the snot started to dry up and I had to get up and blow my nose. And those precious, crucial seconds are what we call in-between moments. It's the moment in between sadness and grief. It's the moment in between when we've allowed ourselves to biologically process out the intensity of those emotions. It's the moment in between where what we felt is not what we're currently feeling, or at least to the same extreme. And we have the opportunity in that moment to ask ourselves perhaps the most important question, which is, how would this person want me to live? So the question I would ask myself is, how would Al want me to live? How would he want me to carry on my life? What would he want me to do in this very moment? The reason that's so important is because what my core belief is that how we choose to live after someone we love is gone is how we choose to honor them. And how we choose to honor them is ultimately the legacy that they'll have in our life. If we choose to live in a way that's in alignment with how we know they'd want them to live, they would want us to live, imagine how beautiful that legacy would be. But if you live a life that is consumed by grief, guilt, shame, and many of the other accompanying emotions that come after loss, consider that the legacy. I know you would never want that legacy inspired in me. Now, that puts a hell of a lot of responsibility on the individual, right? And this is, again, not to diminish what we're feeling. It is so important to feel and process that very sacred time that we call grief and despair and mourn the loss. And what it's also reminding us is that in between the snot, sobs, the tears, the intense feelings, in those little in-between moments, those are the building blocks of the foundation for the next chapter of our life. The next chapter where we have the opportunity to evolve our relationship with those we've lost. Not leave it behind. Because while they may not physically be here still, the love, the connection that you had in life, there's a beautiful love that can still be accessible in death. But to do that, you have to be willing to build a relationship based on love with those you've lost. Because love will not be present in guilt and grief.
Well, then. Man, there is so much to chew on, so much to unpack. I really appreciate your perspective, your wisdom. And you're so right, Jesse. We can be very quick to lose ourselves in the process of grief. We forget about life.
Yeah.
And you talk about legacy. You talk about honoring those who have passed. Now, the friend that you lost to suicide, Gabe, you and I both did an event around suicide where we put a voice to it. We put a face to it. We talk about lessons learned. And in that sense, Jesse, I mean, the way that you have honored Gabe through just the awareness, the education is inspirational to say the least, admirable. When you alluded to your best friend who died in an automobile accident, I mean, the world knows that individual as Paul Walker from the Fast and the Furious movies. You know him as your best friend. You have done something, what I think is very interesting, to honor Paul on his birthday. Do you mind just sharing what it is that you have done and why?
Yeah, Al, thank you. You almost got me to start crying there by inviting me to share this. Tears can be a beautiful thing. I think when you allow yourself to, when you give yourself permission to feel and feel through the emotions, I used to be terrified of crying because I thought that meant I was weak. I thought that meant that I was broken. Where I'm about to cry right now, because as I've come to know you, Al, and love and respect you, I appreciate so much the kind gesture you just did to give me opportunity to share something that's so special and meaningful to me. And I'm deeply touched by that. And that's why there's almost tears in my eyes right now. A couple years before Paul had passed, after my dad and Gabe had died, I found myself struggling so much that I created this kind of self-challenge, and I don't think we have time to go in with it today, but one of the things, one of the challenges within the challenges, there was this event that I ended up creating called International Sunrise Sunset Day. And on that day, I had people invite people who are following me along on social media to take a photo of the sunrise or sunset from wherever they were and share it. And what was really beautiful is on that first day, we had people from, gosh, like 30 different countries participate. There's people sending photos in, and you saw the sunrise at the Eiffel Tower and setting over the mountains in Peru. And just, it was so incredible. And I remember the next year, people who had done it asked, are you going to do that again? I said, yeah, hell, why not? You know, we'll do it again. That first year, Paul had been away filming a movie, and I remember sending it to him, and he was in the time zone. It was like 9 hours difference. And it wasn't uncommon for us to call each other in the time zone difference. So it'd be in the middle of the night for one of us, and we'd sit there in the middle of the nights talking for hours in the middle of the nights. So our respected girlfriends really loved that, because they'd be trying to sleep and we'd be sitting there gossiping like little school kids. and giggling. And I had told him about this sunrise sunset thing and sent him. And I remember he was over there with a couple of friends, and he wrote me back and he said, hey man, I just got to tell you, me and all the boys are sitting around watching your video. All of us are trying not to cry. That was so beautiful. And over the course of our friendship, I subjected him to getting up early and staying up, you know, not staying up late, I guess, but just going out and really appreciating the celestial sky so many times and just being present to what I feel is two of the most sacred times a day. After he died, my greatest fear was this person who I loved and cared about so deeply would be remembered only as a movie star. That was a job he did. It was nothing even close to who he was as a human. And I thought, gosh, wouldn't it be cool if we took Sunrise Sunset Day and rolled it over and making it into an event to help fundraise for the nonprofit that Paul had started. And that was kind of the original piece, is let's do it as a fundraiser for it. And we did that, and we raised a bunch of money for Reach Out Worldwide, which is the nonprofit. And Reach Out Worldwide does disaster relief. So they go in and act as kind of like a first responder in agencies that are affected by natural disasters. For the next 2 years after Paul died, that was what Sunrise Sunset Day was. Is it served as kind of this head for helping do fundraising for Reach Out Worldwide. But as more and more people started to become involved in it, I kept asking myself the question, what would Paul want to see this event evolve into? How would he want me to continue to honor him? What would he want me to grow it into? And it became very clear that he'd want me to evolve it where it's not just about him, but it's about everybody. It's a day for people from all walks of life, everywhere in the world, to stop and honor their loved ones. And so now what we do is every year on September 12th, people from all over the world, which September 12th is Paul's birthday, people from all over the world are invited to share a photo of a sunrise or sunset from wherever they are in the world and honor their loved ones. And what I ask them to do is when they're taking their photo, just to take a moment to be present to their loved one. Smile about a special time, think of a memory, you know, whisper the I love yous, whatever your spiritual religious relationship is for you, you know, be present to that. And then I encourage them to either one, perform an act of kindness, or two, make a donation to an organization that their loved one would have been a fan of. So perform an act of kindness in honor of their loved one, or to make an donation to some sort of organization that their loved one would have been a fan to, animal organization, cancer foundation, whatever that is. And it's really incredible. Out to date, we've had, I think, 110 plus countries participate, all seven continents, even Antarctica. We got a sunrise sunset from the research station in Antarctica a couple of years. And we've raised, gosh, I don't even know, well over $100,000+ for various charities. And it's amazing. It's my favorite holiday every year. And I then take some of it and put it into a photo and video story. And yeah, it's really special.
That's pretty neat. I mean, I know that someone listening right now, Stacy, takes part in it. And it's just fascinating, Jesse, for me to think about how we started off this podcast. You know, that 7 or 8 year old young boy, so much shame, so much loss, so much confusion. And how you've been able to transform that, and how you did it, is because you gave yourself permission to feel. You understood the need to reach out for help, that you didn't have to fight on your own. And for those, Jesse, who are interested in following you or even taking part in this event in the future, what would the best way be to do that?
Yeah, all social media, everything is Jesse Brisenine, at Jesse Brisenine. You'll find me through a quick Google search. Website, Jesse Brisenine. You type me in, you'll find me.
And I know, Jesse, you also offer coaching. You have impacted numerous people through coaching. Would that be the best way as well if people wanted to gather some more information about how you could potentially assist them on their journey?
Yeah, coaching, Al, and then I've shared with you too. I'm really terrified of what the mental health fallout is going to be for COVID here in the States. It's, and I'm leaning into doing some more trainings specifically focused on mental health that I can take into organizations, run workshops for companies, and just really how do we take care of mental emotional health in the post-COVID world? I think it's going to be essential. As vaccines come in, as whatever happens, there's a lot of people who are struggling in here and here through this whole time. And that's not to make small of what's going on with the disease. It's just to acknowledge there's this other piece of it. And I'll be doing a lot of work in that area to try to support people through that as well.
Beautiful. There are people who dream, and I guess there are people who do. You've always been someone who does. You definitely walk the talk. And that's something that I appreciate about you. You've always been very vulnerable, very transparent. And what you've been able to do, Jesse, I'm incredibly proud of you. I'm incredibly honored to be able to call you a friend. And I'm very excited to see where you take life. All of the loved ones who have passed before you, no doubt, are all around and must be so proud of who Jesse Brisenine is. So I thank you for taking the time. Thank you for sharing so many valuable teachings. And to anyone tuning in, yeah, definitely please take the time to follow Jesse through social media. Your posts are not just one-liners either. I mean, you write novels, my friend. And there's just so many nuggets. I mean, even this, you touched on so many different things, gave us valuable tools around grief and loss, and much respect. Thank you so much, Jesse. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Al. I appreciate you having me and appreciate you holding the space, man.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you so much, everybody, for taking the time to tune into Mental Health. It's Time to Talk. Take care and be well.